companies they created, which initially had a value of zero. After that, anybody with $1 billion in assets or who received $100 million in earnings for 3 consecutive years would face an annual tax on the gains in value of their publicly traded assets, whether or not they were sold.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
Sheikh Javed Akbari, the researcher on Islamic studies from Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Well, today, in this episode, I'm going to discuss domestic violence. And of course, domestic violence is a very live phenomenon which we need to deal with from different angles and from different perspectives. Domestic violence is a reality. It's undeniable and it is a bitter reality, of course. What do we need to do in order to reduce domestic violence? We know that domestic violence cannot be eliminated under any circumstances, but it can be ameliorated, it can be reduced, and it can be somehow abated. But before we talk about domestic violence in further detail, I would like you to know a definition. Of course, we need to start with a definition. According to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary definition, domestic violence is the inflicting of physical injury by one family or household member on another. And it's also a repeated or habitual pattern of such behavior. So a repeated and a habitual pattern of violence in the family atmosphere, in the family setting, is also considered to be domestic violence. In 1993, the United Nations Declaration on the Elimination of Violence Against Women defined domestic violence as such: physical, sexual, and psychological violence occurring in the family, including battering, sexual abuse of female children in the household, dowry-related violence, marital rape, and female genital mutilation, and other traditional practices harmful to women, non-spousal violence, and violence related to exploitation. So this is a definition offered by the United Nations, of course, in 1993. And domestic violence, violence that occurs within the private sphere, generally between individuals who are related through intimacy, or law. It is nearly always a gender-specific crime perpetrated by men against women, and it is used as a strong form of control and oppression. These are some definitions of domestic violence. The fact of the matter is this, that domestic violence is a real phenomenon that we need to talk about, that we need to discuss. Domestic violence makes life for many women and many children a nightmare. There's no doubt about it. And domestic violence makes life impossible for man and his wife to maintain and to live a good life, to live a better life, of course. And domestic violence is an evil phenomenon that unfortunately exists, and undeniably it exists, of course.
At this time we have a short break, and then we'll listen to the continuation of the speech of Sheikh Javed Akbari. You're listening to For a Better Life from IRIB English Radio.
Dear brothers and sisters, addressing believers, the Holy Quran says, "Believers, be dutiful to Allah and bearers of just witness. Do not allow your hatred for other people to turn you away from justice. Deal justly, it is nearer to piety. Have fear of Allah. Allah is aware of what you do." So this is one verse of the Holy Quran, which is obviously about doing justice, about being just, about not allowing hatred from other people to turn you away from justice. And what is actually important is to be just and to practice justice. يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا كُونُوا قَوَّامِينَ لِلَّهِ شُهَدَاءً بِالْقِسْطِ وَلَا يَجْرِمَنَّكُمْ شَنَآنُ قَوْمٍ عَلَىٰ أَنْ لَا تَعْدِلُوا اِعْدِلُوا هُوَ أَقْرَبُ لِلتَّقْوَى وَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ إِنَّ اللَّهَ خَبِيرٌ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ. So deal justly. اِعْدِلُوا. It is nearer to piety. هُوَ أَقْرَبُ لِلتَّقْوَى وَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ. Have fear of Allah. إن الله خبير بما تعملون. And of course, God is fully aware of what we do and of what you do. So, dear brothers and sisters, obviously, domestic violence is an undeniable phenomenon, and it does exist. But there are verses in the Holy Quran. We need to discuss that specific verse, which is in the Holy Quran and which has been interpreted or maybe translated by different translators differently. We need to use a correct translation of that verse. Of course, we will discuss this in the following episode. To come to a conclusion, first of all, we need to understand the definition of domestic violence. I gave you three definitions of violence. There is a verse in the Holy Quran which says, of course, we need to be just, we need to fear Allah, and we need to deal justly. And of course, the hatred from other people should not make us turn away from justice.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Obviously, everyone should adhere to moral values, understand his or her responsibility, fulfill it, and make sure that he or she acts within the framework of his or her religious and moral obligation, and moral duty. The religion of Islam has set our rights and our obligations. Every individual, whether man or woman, has his or her rights and obligations. If everyone does and fulfills his duties and his responsibilities, of course, complications, problems, and quarrels are less likely to arise. If we fail to do what we are supposed to do, that is when quarrels begin to emerge. And that's when feud, struggle, and of course, internal violence and domestic violence begins to emerge. And in order for us to live a prosperous life, in order for us to live a better life, we need to change our behavior, we need to follow the teachings of the Holy Quran, and we need to follow the teachings of the infallibles, the Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him and his family, and the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salatu wassalam. Inshallah, I will follow this discussion in the next episode. Until then, wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was all for this program. Inshallah, we'll listen to other episode of this program, For a Better Life, same time, same channel. Fi amanillah.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. Your love is all I need. So all I need. Your love is all I need. So all I need. Your love is all I need. All I need. Oh, oh, oh. Your love is all I need. Love is all I need.
In the limelight. According to one recent international survey, about 10% of those with COVID-related smell loss experienced parosmia in the immediate aftermath of the disease. And this rose to 47% when the respondents were interviewed again 6 or 7 months later. We now present you an article written by Linda Giddies. The piece is titled Fresh Air or Foul Odor? How COVID can distort the sense of smell. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Most people are aware that a cardinal symptom of COVID-19 is loss of smell, or anosmia. It may last for weeks or even months. Increasingly, though, those who have recovered subsequently develop another disorienting symptom, parosmia, or a distorted sense of smell. This typically results in things that once smelled pleasant smelling bad or rotten. COVID-19 isn't the only cause. Head injuries and other types of infection can also trigger it. But SARS-CoV-2 appears particularly adept at setting off this sensory confusion. According to one recent international survey, about 10% of those with COVID-related smell loss experienced parosmia in the immediate aftermath of the disease. And this rose to 47% when the respondents were interviewed again 6 or 7 months later. The researchers calculated, based on current infection estimates, there could be as many as 7 million people worldwide with parosmia as a result of COVID-19. Dr. Dweka Burgess-Watson of Newcastle University, who has been studying the psychological impact of parosmia, says this is on a scale that we've never seen before. Nor is it just a problem of the nose. Dr. Burgess-Watson says it can have a profound impact on your quality of life, from how you eat to how you socialize or engage with significant others, down to the level of whether you actually feel safe going out of your house or not. Leslie Matthews, a 52-year-old from Bolton, lost her sense of smell after catching COVID-19 in January. It started coming back in August, but most toiletries and foodstuffs smell alien to her. She says, "I have two main distorted smells. The first is a chemical-type smell, which is present in most toiletries and carbonated drinks. All fragrance and aftershaves have the same disgusting smell, which makes even passing people when shopping intolerable." She notes, "The second is what I can only liken to the awful smell of a rotten fruit. All meats, cooked or otherwise, smell of this. Again, along with anything toasting, roasting or fried." Because so many foods trigger her parosmia, Leslie Matthews' diet is currently restricted to a handful of safe foods, including porridge, scrambled eggs, poached salmon, grapes and sultanas. And she feels nauseous within seconds of someone switching on a toaster. She says, "I can't go into a coffee shop and I'm constantly making excuses not to socialize, as it is no longer a pleasant experience." Restricted eating and weight loss is common among those with parosmia, Watson says. Other people start overeating because their altered sense of smell leaves them feeling unsatisfied after meals. Also common is an altered perception of body odor, both one's own and other people's. Watson says, "That can lead to a loss of social intimacy, either because you're too scared to be in the company of others or you find the company of others triggers your parosmia," adding, "I have seen cases of people feeling that they had to leave their friends because they couldn't stand the smell of them. How do you tell the person you love that you find the smell of them disgusting?" One of the worst cases she recently encountered was a person whose parosmia was triggered by the smell of fresh air. Dr. Dweka Burgess-Watson says, "They literally couldn't even move from room to room in their own house. If they walked outside, they felt the disgusting smell of the air permeated everything." The good news is that scientists are beginning to unpick the molecular mechanisms of parosmia, which could eventually lead to better ways of treating it. On the roof of the nasal cavity, about 7 centimeters behind the nostrils, is a thin membrane studded with specialized cells called olfactory sensory neurons, which capture odor molecules from the air we breathe in and out and send electrical signals to the brain area that processes them. Infections such as COVID-19 can damage these neurons. The current leading theory is that they regenerate. Miswiring and disordered signaling can occur, resulting in parosmia. Chrissy Kelly, founder of the smell loss charity Absent, who has suffered from parosmia since developing a sinus infection in 2012, says, "If there is anything amiss with the whole chain of command among the olfactory nerves, then the brain cannot receive a complete signal." She adds, "That's when you get these people reporting strange smells that they can't really describe, that are difficult to pin down. Triggers vary from person to person, but many of the same substances often crop up. Coffee, meat, onion, garlic, eggs, chocolate, shower gel, and toothpaste. Separate research by Dr. Jane Parker of the University of Reading and colleagues is beginning to shed light on why these substances are so problematic. In recent experiments, they broke the aroma of coffee down into its constituent molecular parts and ran them under the noses of people with parosmia and unaffected volunteers. This showed that parosmia is not linked to a person's ability to smell. Rather, there are certain compounds that evoke feelings of disgust in many people with parosmia, but which unaffected people tend to describe as pleasant. Many contain sulfur or nitrogen, although not all such compounds are triggers. They also tend to be detectable by the human nose at very low concentrations. The most frequently reported trigger in coffee was 2-furanmethaninethiol, which unaffected participants described as roasty, popcorn, or smoky smelling. Parker says many people with parosmia describe it as just new coffee. That's how my coffee smells now, adding, others described it as awful, disgusting. They've never smelled anything like it before. The fact that there's a common set of triggers suggests people are not imagining the unpleasantness that they're experiencing. It also supports the miswiring hypothesis, although if this is occurring, it seems not to be happening at random. Further research may determine why these triggers elicit such a strong parosmic response and possibly inform future treatment. For now, Dr. Watson recommends that anyone suffering from parosmia write a list of all their triggers and stick it somewhere that other household members can see it, so they can help them avoid these substances or find alternatives. For instance, many of the compounds that Parker and her colleagues have identified are created during the chemical reaction that gives roasted, fried, or toasted food its distinctive flavor. Different cooking techniques might render the same foods less offensive. Another unanswered question is how long those recovering from COVID-19 can expect their parosmia to persist. Dr. Parker says the people that had it pre-COVID were taking anything from 6 months to 2 or 3 years to recover, so it's a long process. Kelly says for some individuals, certain objects may never smell precisely how they remember them, but that doesn't mean their quality of life won't dramatically improve. She says, you have to look for healing and for a quality of life that makes you feel good about your day-to-day experiences. She adds, that's got to be the yardstick for recovery.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson, Signs of a Believer. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Islam says that all men are born with a pure, primordial nature, which believes in and loves to do good. Taints and sins begin to gradually affect his spirit and soul and change his nature, and in time turn it totally. When you see that a man is interested in goodness and hates bad deeds, you know that the spirit of belief and first pure nature still exist in him. What a miserable lot are those who, instead of being disturbed by their bad deeds, take pleasure in them, or who are resentful for their deeds of self-sacrifice, righteousness, forgiveness, and justice. They are the unbelievers. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam has said, "When your good deed makes you happy and your bad deed disturbs you, you are a believer." See, this natural inclination that we have towards goodness, it is a blessing of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He has created us in such a way that we automatically get attracted towards goodness. And similarly, He has created us in such a way that we are automatically, by nature, repellent to evil and badness. This is a blessing of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is a gift of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We should value it. We should keep it alive in our lives. This is what the battle is all about, the battle between good and evil, truth and falsehood. So make sure you pick the right side. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing some of the signs of a believer. While we have many traditions from Prophet and Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, in which they have mentioned numerous signs of a believer, we're discussing this sign of being happy and attracted towards goodness and good deeds. And this sign also includes being repellent and being disturbed by carrying out or noticing bad deeds or evil. Right? This whole phenomena of good versus evil, righteousness versus, you know, falsehood, this is something built into our nature. We need to nurture it. We need to cater to it. We need to listen to it. So let me give you a very simple example. If God forbid, you're in a situation where you feel attracted towards performing a sin, have you ever noticed that there is a voice that you hear from within yourself that stops you or alerts you? It's like a red flag. It's like, no, don't do it. This consciousness that you have, it is that system that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has put in you to keep you away from evil. Listen to it. Now, let's say you decide not to listen to it. What would happen? Well, first off, you're going to end up, God forbid, doing that sin. Second off, this inner voice of yours is going to start losing hope in you. You do it 10 times that you don't listen, for instance, 12 times, 15 times, I don't know, 3 times, whatever. You do it in a recurring fashion, that inner self gives up on you, and that voice becomes silenced, buried under the rubble of sins. So if you're a believer, cater to the side that is calling you towards goodness. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight. Huge spending on the military has undermined U.S. economic growth. Increased spending on defense meant less funding allocated to education and other socio-economic programs. This misallocation of resources was a major reason the U.S. economy was slowing down, made worse by COVID-19 pandemic and the trade war between the United States and China. We're prepared for you an article written by Ken Moak. Ken Moak taught economic theory, public policy, and globalization at university level for 33 years. The article is titled, Why Majority of Americans Support Costly Foreign Policies. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Democrats and Republicans may be at each other's throats when it comes to domestic policy, spending, and the size of U.S. government. But they are on the same page on foreign policies, protecting American supremacy or stifling any country that is in a position to challenge U.S. interests. In doing so, the U.S. government has spent lavishly and demanded that its allies do the same to stifle the purported China-Russia threat. Former President Donald Trump renamed the Asia-Pacific region Indo-Pacific, increasing Freedom of Navigation Operations, or FONOPs, and reviving the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, or Quad. Donald Trump also demanded that NATO allies increase defense spending to 2% of their gross domestic product, or GDP. Current President Joe Biden not only carried on with Donald Trump's foreign policies on China and Russia, but has in fact intensified them. Joe Biden wanted to formalize and expand the Quad into a military alliance that would include South Korea, Vietnam, and others. However, huge spending on the military has undermined U.S. economic growth. Increased spending on defense meant less funding allocated to education and other socio-economic programs. This misallocation of resources was a major reason the U.S. economy was slowing down, made worse by the COVID-19 pandemic and U.S.-China trade wars. Escalating tensions in the Asia-Pacific region and politicizing the origins of COVID-19 have worsened the security environment, climate warming, and the pandemic. Holding frequent Freedom of Navigation Operations, or FONOPs, in the Asia-Pacific region has triggered an arms race of some sort between the United States and China. Each country is spending more and more on weapons development and weapons production. The Freedom of Navigation Operations and China's tit-for-tat response have a real possibility of turning the situation into a hot war. Costly and dangerous as U.S. foreign policies are, still the majority of the American public support them. For example, most American farmers, the most harmed by the trade wars, supported Donald Trump and his China policies because they wrongly believe China is a threat to U.S. national interests. This raises the question, why do most Americans support these self-inflicting harmful policies? One answer is that the so-called yellow peril narrative is not far below the skin for many Americans, believing China is a national economic and national security threat. Another is the role of groups that benefit from confrontational policies. U.S. foreign policies have turned out to be hugely profitable not only for the military-industrial complex, but also for the financial institutions, for the think tanks and the media. For example, weapons producers require large loans from banks to fulfill contractual obligations. Publishing subjective news about adversaries increased readership. Think tanks and pundits received large rewards to spin the anti-Chinese rhetoric, so there is real incentive for these groups to cheer and to lobby the government to implement confrontational policies. A case in point is how the military-industrial complex has succeeded in inventing an enemy, shaping public policies by manipulating public opinion against it, making generous election campaign donations to both major political parties, and dispersing weapons production across the country. In the aftermath of the Second World War, the United States turned against the Soviet Union, accusing it of expanding wrong ideology to Europe and to the world. The United States first instituted the Marshall Plan, showering countries with money that were willing to toe the line on American values and ideals. The recipients were also required to spend the funds on U.S. goods and services. The United States then established the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, a military alliance composed of democratic Western nations to counter Soviet Union. The formation of NATO proved profitable for the military-industrial complex because it could not only sell arms to the United States, but to its allies as well. However, spending more on defense against the perceived enemy undermined economic growth at home because less was allocated to education and to other socio-economic programs. At the same time, escalated tensions with the former Soviet Union heightened the security risk in Europe and at home. The Soviet Union responded with the establishment of the Warsaw Pact, a military club consisting of itself and Eastern European countries. The conflicts between US and Western Europe and the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe led to the Cold War, under which both sides spent huge amounts of money on defense. The collapse of the former Soviet Union thus brought joy to Americans because it was supposed to generate a peace dividend. They thought the money that was being spent on weapons would be reallocated to education, to healthcare, and employment creation programs. However, the opposite was true. Instead of bringing economic growth, the economy slowed down. This was because the states that depended on defense spending, such as California, turned into economic basket cases. Furthermore, declining military spending hurt the bottom line of the military-industrial complex, forcing them to lay off workers. To reverse the economic and financial misfortunes, an enemy had to be created. China became the ideal candidate because it was Asian, and most important of all, in a position to challenge America's hegemony in almost, if not all, fields. China's successful economy with Chinese characteristics, development, architecture allowed the country to become a near-peer power to the United States. The Asian power was able to reject the U.S.-imposed world order and compete with the United States in most, if not all, fields, including in technology and military. China's rise was unacceptable to both the U.S. Democrats and U.S. Republicans, in that foreign policies were configured to maintain global dominance and protect national security. What's more, politicians on both sides of the political divide were obligated to defend the military-industrial complex's interests. Politicians, particularly those sitting on the Congressional Armed Services Committees and representing weapons-producing states, received generous campaign donations from the military-industrial complex. This was meant to influence the lawmakers to make favorable decisions. It worked, as the overly bloated U.S. defense budget of more than $750 billion attests. The politicians gained because they were seen as bringing home the bacon or looking after the nation's interests. Increasing weapons purchases translated into greater economic and employment opportunities. Anti-China politicians were also seen as the so-called patriots, defending America from its enemies, though no country has ever threatened the United States. Demonizing China was largely responsible for Donald Trump winning the White House race in 2016. Anti-China and anti-Russia sentiments were manipulated by politicians with the help of the media and pundits. For instance, the Washington Post published the allegation that the coronavirus had caused the COVID-19 pandemic was actually leaked from Wuhan Institute of Virology without bothering to verify the claim. The same was true on other issues. The media and pundits kept on accusing the Chinese government of committing genocide and forced labor in Xinjiang without any credible evidence. Indeed, it could be argued that the charges did not make much sense and were contrary to what was happening on the ground. So there is no surprise that U.S. politicians, senior officials, and even presidents acted as arms salesmen, influencing allies and friends to buy American-made weapons against China and other like-minded governments. As indicated earlier, weapons manufacturing is big business, at least for the few that benefited directly from it. Whether U.S. confrontational foreign policies serve the national interest would depend on one's perspective. But there is evidence to suggest that these policies have heightened national security risks, undermined economic growth, widened the gap between the rich and the poor, and increased poverty. The trade wars with China have worsened U.S. economic woes, increasing production costs and consumer prices. Worse, the U.S. trade deficit with China has actually increased and manufacturing activities decreased, the very reasons for the trade wars. Focusing on war and aggression instead of education and healthcare has diluted the quality and productiveness of the American labor force. In the era of globalization, this is a no-no because poor quality and unhealthy workers will not be able to compete in the world market.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Round. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September the 2nd, 2021. I always offered a piece of advice to all officials in previous terms. Time passes quickly, and these 4 years will be over very soon. In his very important governmental decree to Malik Ashtar, the Commander of the Faithful, alayhi salam, considers all these aspects. I advise all you friends to go take a look at it. It says, then do not keep yourself secluded from the people for a long time. Of course, scholars have put forth other variations and other suggestions for this part. To not seclude oneself. It means that a ruler should not be absent from the people for a long time. Officials cannot, of course, be constantly present among the people, but in some periods of time they should certainly be present. To not isolate oneself from the people means to not lengthen your absence from the people.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
After expanding on this, the Commander of the Faithful says, if the subjects suspect you of high-handedness, explain to them your position openly. If there is a doubt in the minds of the people about you, you should present your explanations to them and speak to them openly. Notice that the relationship between the ruler and the people should be like this. This relationship is a brotherly and friendly one, and remove their suspicion with your explanation. Nahjul Balagha, letter 53. In other words, if they have a doubt, you should dispel it with your words and your explanations. These were explanations about popularity. Therefore, you should really try to observe these aspects of popularity. Officials in all sectors should have these qualities. The next key word is the administration of justice, which is the basis of the Islamic government and the Islamic Republic. Actually, all religions are based on the administration of justice. God the Exalted says that He sent prophets and heavenly books that people may maintain justice. The Holy Quran, chapter 57, verse
25. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The night in March 2021 that 33-year-old Sarah Everard was arrested, raped and murdered by police officer Wayne Curzons. He has been handed a life sentence, but since the murder, public trust in the force has plummeted. In 4 years, 2,000 officers have been accused of sexual misconduct, including rape. Nearly two-thirds of them have faced no further action. And a quarter of misconduct hearings are closed to the public. Britain's most senior police officer has promised a thorough investigation into the Met's culture, and the Independent Force for Police Conduct says it is dealing with a slew of new referrals since it changed the criteria for abuse of power for sexual purposes.
But is it about referral criteria or something more ingrained and sinister? Curzons was nicknamed the rapist by his colleagues. So why wasn't he weeded out earlier by the Met?
Climate change is sort of steroids for the weather. That's what experts say. From the northernmost to the southernmost points of the Earth, nowhere and no one is immune to this crisis. In India, people have been devastated by frequent heat waves.
We are affected a lot by this unbearable heat, and us poor are hit the hardest.
And so are Canadians.
It's just unbearable. It's impossible to be out.
This year, July was declared the world's hottest month ever recorded. A recent study shows if the world's emission of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases continues at the same level, in 30 years' time, there will be a climate change apocalypse. That means outdoor life in parts of the Middle East and North Africa would be impossible, regions that are already facing long periods of extreme heat.
We are very tired and cannot stand in the sun. Our situation is very bad. We are exhausted.
Researchers are now warning that even animals and plants are in danger. In a bid to survive, some countries are already looking for new ways to adapt to these intense situations. In Bangladesh, one of the countries worst affected by the extreme weather in recent decades, farmers are developing floating seedbeds and salt-resistant rice to avoid unpredictable conditions.
This is the digital age. We saw on YouTube how greenhouse farming works. We tried it on a smaller scale, though. I am doing greenhouse farming this year on 8,000 square feet of land.
Estimates show that $5 trillion a year are needed by 2030 to find measures to fight global warming. But despite signs of progress in a few sectors, the majority of the tasks required for curbing the rising temperatures still seem to be far-fetched. And many are now saying that the upcoming United Nations conference, COP26, is the last major chance to galvanize a collective effort to fight climate change.
Unless there are immediate, rapid, and large-scale reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, we will be unable to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius, and the consequences will be catastrophic. COP26 this November must mark that turning point. By then, we need all countries to commit to achieve net zero emissions by the middle of this century and to present clear, credible, long-term strategies to get there.
All these are reminders that the fatal consequences of this human-induced crisis are threatening our planet now more than ever before.
Thank you.
Afghanistan has welcomed the recent remarks by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who called for greater unity between Sunnis and Shias. This according to a tweet by a spokesman of the political office of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, Muhammad Naeem Wardak. He further said the Taliban are aware of the nation's enemies' scheme and work for tightening brotherhood among Afghan people.
The U.S. has always been trying to deepen the schism between Muslim sects, both after the invasion and after the withdrawal. They don't stop their conspiracy, but the Islamic Emirate is aware of it and will never let the enemies of Islam reach their goals. However, they target Shias, but in fact, they are against all of us.
Afghan people have also welcomed Iran's leader's remarks. In a conference titled Islamic Unity Week and the Responsibility of People in the Afghan capital on Tuesday, the participants said Islamic unity should be part of culture in Muslim world.
Prominent Islamic scholar and the late founder of Iran's Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini, in a very critical point of time came and named this week as Islamic Unity Week, so that all Muslims keep their unity and brotherhood. We all have the same God, Prophet, and Qibla. Then let's benefit from these mutual values for our unity and make it a culture.
Addressing the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference in the Iranian capital, Iran's leader touched on the U.S. campaign to stoke sedition among Islamic countries with the help of its proxies. He said the recent unfortunate and distressing explosions at mosques targeting Muslim worshippers in Afghanistan are among such incidents that were carried out by Daesh. Earlier this month, Daesh terrorist group conducted two deadly attacks against Shia community in Afghanistan. Following the attacks, Muslim leaders noted that such incidents are meant to divide Muslims in the war-torn country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
France's latest unemployment data showed a small improvement, but unemployment remains nearly 8%, at least officially. 5.9 million people remain unemployed, which is just a fraction less than the all-time high of 6.3 million in 2017. Back in September 2008, the total jobless numbered just 4.5 million. That means French unemployment has risen over 30% since the start of the Great Recession. With re-election just 6 months away, many say that Macron is running out of time to devote resources to the jobless or to devise a new system of accounting. Macron campaigned on a promise to bring unemployment under 7%.
His effort, or his promise to increase employment by changing labor laws that would make France more attractive to foreign investors just hasn't worked. This idea of bringing in migrants for cheap labor to keep wages down is a real issue. So it's a big problem for Macron.
Under Macron's predecessor, François Hollande, the jobless rate increased 44 out of 46 months at one point. To change that, Hollande controversially started excluding part-time underemployed workers from the official count. Macron went one better and declared that just looking for work once in the past month no longer makes someone unemployed. Macron also began revealing jobless data only once every 3 months to avoid media discussion of the unpopular issue.
We have to really distinguish between what the official unemployment rate is and what the unofficial unemployment rate is. And if we take what the potential workforce is, it's much, much higher. And it's really amazing because the service sectors, like restaurants and bars and stores and stuff, can't find people to fill positions. And the reason is they don't pay enough.
For years, many French economists have said that the official unemployment rate is undercounted by a third, which would put the real unemployment rate at well over 20%. The Macron era had been one of constant economic unrest, but the coronavirus pause seems to have ended, with protests recently increasing in number and intensity. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
President of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, has sent a stern message to the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, slamming the world body's inaction regarding Saudi Arabia's bloody war on Yemen.